Good afternoon. My name is Steve Luckable, and I'd like to welcome you to the Hepatitis C Virus Treatment Guidelines webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the Partnerships for Care HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, HIV-TAC. The Partnerships for Care project is a three-year, multi-agency project funded by the Secretary's Minority AIDS Initiative Fund and the Affordable Care Act. The goals of the project are to expand provision of HIV testing, prevention, care, and treatment in health centers serving communities highly impacted by HIV, to build sustainable partnerships between health centers and their state health department, and to improve health outcomes among people living with HIV, especially among racial and ethnic minorities. The project is supported by the HIV Training, Technical Assistance, and Collaboration Center, HIV-TAC. Before we get started, we'd like to note that continuing medical education, continuing nursing education, and continuing education credits are jointly being provided for this webinar by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and the MyoTech Corporation. As a requirement for issuing the continuing education credits, the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine requires instructors, planners, managers, and other individuals who are in a position to control the content of this activity to disclose any real or apparent conflict of interest. Our faculty and our speakers have no commercial interest to disclose related to the content of this continuing education activity. This webinar has been approved for a maximum of one AMA PRA Category 1 credit. The webinar has been approved for one contact hour of continuing nursing education, and the Postgraduate Institute of Medicine is accredited by the IACET and is authorized to issue IACET CEUs. You can download detailed instructions on how to obtain your CME, CNE, or CE certificate via the Handouts tab on the GoToWebinar toolbar. Please note that first-time users to the Postgraduate Institute of Medicine Continuing Education Portal will have to create an account and profile in order to have access to the continuing education credits. You will only have to do this once, so for future webinars where we offer credits, you won't need to repeat this process. If you have any questions related to this, please contact the PIM in the email address and phone number listed on the slide. Our speaker today is Dr. Stacy Truskin. Dr. Truskin is the Director of Viral Hepatitis Programs at Philadelphia Flight Community Health Centers. She received her MPH from Yale University School of Public Health and her medical degree from Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and her PhD from Rutgers School of Public Health. She completed her internal medicine residency and infectious disease fellowship at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Truskin's primary research interests focus on health disparities and developing and evaluating models of HCV care. Dr. Truskin serves as the Chief Medical Advisor to the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable and is a member of the American Association of the Study of Liver Diseases and the Infectious Disease Society of America's HCV Guidelines Committee. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Truskin.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you all over this lunch hour. For those of you that are on the East Coast and a little bit earlier, if those of you are listening are further to the West, today we're going to spend the next hour talking about the AASLD IDSA HCV treatment guidelines, and we're really going to focus on the co-infected patient. And I think that I don't want anyone to participate in the next hour thinking that you're going to walk away knowing everything there is to know about how to treat patients, but really what I'd like to do is give you an overview of the resources that are available to you and kind of give you the tools to help you navigate through the AASLD IDSA website treatment guidelines so that you can feel much more comfortable as you move forward and treat this population. So the objectives in the next hour are to discuss the treatment guidelines that are recommended by AASLD and IDSA and describe the main treatment options for HCV infection among HIV-infected patients, which you will see is identical to those who are HCV mono-infected, and list both host and viral factors that influence the duration and or type of antiviral treatment that we choose. So I think it's really important to recognize here that the AASLD IDSA guidance really should be considered a living and sort of breathing document, and it's updated frequently. In fact, we just updated the website within the last 2 to 3 weeks. We have both on their FDA-approved regimens, but we may also recommend off-label use of certain drugs or tests. And there is this disclaimer that's on the website. This guidance for the hepatitis C treatment in adults is changing constantly, And we actually recommend that you view the guidance through www.hcvguidelines.org for the latest recommendations, and sort of urge people who are using this as a resource to not print it out and use it as a manual, because we do update them quite often. And so what you may have one day could be outdated a week later. And so definitely use the web version as the reference. This is what the homepage looks like, and this is revamped, just rolled out a few weeks ago, and I actually really think that the committee members did a tremendous job. I think for those of you that can remember the Hardy Boys choose your own adventure type of model, we have a little bit of that now on the website. If you look at the bar across the top, there's a home with a little arrow next to it, the test, evaluate, and monitor, and then treatment naive, treatment experienced, unique populations. And so basically what it allows you to do is say, well, am I here to talk about how to test, evaluate, or monitor my patient? Then you can pull down that menu. But the next two bars are perhaps the most important. You either need to know whether your patient is treatment naive, so never experienced any treatment in the past for hepatitis C, versus treatment experienced. And now treatment experience can be defined as an interferon-based regimen or any DAA regimen that was either used with or without interferon. And then it pulls it down and you determine whether or not your patient is cirrhotic and what genotype they have. And then it takes you to the page that is specifically designed to address the patient with those specific characteristics. So again, treatment experience versus not, cirrhotic versus not, and then what genotype they have. And then you can really hone in on what are the current recommended treatments for your specific patient. So it's a much more user-friendly model of the guidance. And I think we're quite proud of that. And I hope you all find it easy to navigate moving forward. So I wanted to just start off by setting the table here with a little bit of a review about hepatitis C. We're not going to spend too much time on that, but I think reviewing the natural history of hepatitis C reminds us and really informs the conversation around testing for hepatitis C as well. So we know that in individuals who are exposed to hepatitis C, about 75 to 85% will go on and develop chronic infection. And for reasons that are not completely understood, related to both host and viral factors, 15 to 25% will have spontaneous resolution. Those individuals will have antibody to hepatitis C, but they will not have a viral load or viral RNA present in their blood. For those that go on and develop chronic hepatitis C, it causes inflammation within the liver, hepatic fibrosis. This can be accelerated by alcohol, HIV co-infection, hepatitis B as well. And over time, it can be as short as 20 years, but sometimes quicker than that even. And the literature has further increased the percentage that will go on and develop cirrhosis of the liver to as high as 40% in some publications. So anywhere from 20 to 40% will go on and develop cirrhosis in the decades following infection. And that, of course, is not a good thing because it puts individuals at risk for hepatocellular carcinoma and hepatic decompensation. We know that the prevalence of HIV hepatitis C co-infection is high, and this is because of shared routes of transmission. We know that about 30% of individuals living with HIV are co-infected with hepatitis C, and that amounts to around 400,000 in the United States. And the prevalence varies based on the likely mode of acquisition. So we know that among HIV-positive individuals that got their HIV through a history of injection drug use, 90% will be co-infected with hepatitis C. Anywhere from 60 to 85% will be infected if it was through a blood transfusion, and 4 to 8% among men who have sex with men will be co-infected with hepatitis C. Antiretroviral therapy has really revolutionized the lifespan and the quality of life that our patients with HIV now experience, but it also has impacted the morbidity and mortality that we now see in our co-infected patients that is associated with hepatitis C. So antiretroviral therapy has caused a huge decrease in AIDS-related complications, allowing our patients to live longer, but that allows more time for hepatitis C to do its work. And liver disease is now the second leading cause of death in our HIV patients. and it's primarily caused by chronic hepatitis C. I think this is really important for us to remember because we can now cure hepatitis C, and we'll talk a little bit about that as the hour goes on. So really, there should be no reason why in our HIV patients, we are not working towards elimination of hepatitis C in this population. And as a result, really reducing the morbidity and mortality related to hepatitis C in our co-infected patients. Hepatitis C and HIV have a complex interplay with each other. Okay, for those that are exposed to hepatitis C and go on and develop chronic infection, we know that HIV accelerates the rates and the risk of developing cirrhosis, as well as hepatocellular carcinoma and end-stage liver disease. And in fact, HIV co-infection decreases the rates of clearance of hepatitis C. So co-infected individuals are going to be less likely to clear hepatitis C on their own. They're going to have higher rates of hepatitis C RNA levels, increased risk of cirrhosis, increased risk of end-stage liver disease and hepatic decompensation, and increased risk of hepatocellular carcinoma. And I think sort of the other really important thing here that we tend to forget is that 30 to 50% of co-infected individuals have alcohol use disorders. And we know that alcohol and hepatitis C don't mix. They each individually can cause cirrhosis of the liver. And what I tell my patients is that when you drink alcohol in the setting of hepatitis C, it's like pouring gasoline on fire, that the rates of fibrosis and development of cirrhosis are going to be accelerated substantially. And so we know there's no safe amount of alcohol use in the setting of hepatitis C, that abstaining from alcohol use is best, although for many of our patients that have addiction, comorbid conditions, that's not realistic. And then that's where harm reduction and modifying the amount of alcohol at least will try to come into play. So when we think about the recommendations for testing that are put forth by AASLD, IDSA, these are the recommendations that are published in really last week's version of the guidelines, which are still accurate today. But again, I remind you that moving forward in time, these may, of course, change. So you always want to use the website as the reference. The AASLD IDSA Guidelines Committee recommends and supports the CDC's guidelines, which are that all individuals born between 1945 and 1965 be tested without prior risk ascertainment. But we also recommend that other persons outside of that birth cohort be screened based on risk factors. So risk behaviors include a history of injection drug use or intranasal illicit drug use, and other risk exposures as well, such as people who have been on long-term hemodialysis, anyone who have had percutaneous or parenteral exposures in unregulated settings, which may include tattooing, healthcare, emergency medical, or public safety workers after needle sticks, children born to HCV-infected women. This is really important as well, particularly for those of us that take care of younger individuals who have been caught up in the opiate epidemic, who are of reproductive age. We're seeing a lot of women in my own practice who are in their 20s and early 30s who may in fact get pregnant. Those children need to be followed and they need to be screened for hepatitis C. We know there is a risk of perinatal transmission that has probably been unrecognized in the past, and we as providers need to do a better job. And then of course, we need to be testing prior recipients or of transfusions or organ transplants, and really individuals who had received an organ or a blood component prior to 1992 need to be tested for hepatitis C, because that was the first year that we were able to screen the blood supply adequately. And then people who have ever been incarcerated as well. And then there are other considerations which really influences our conversation today around HIV infection. So for individuals who are caring for folks who are co-infected with HIV, obviously we recommend testing for hepatitis C, certainly when they come into care. And then if they have ongoing risk, I would recommend screening them annually. That's what we do in our own practice. And then certainly, there's an additional recommendation you can see at the bottom of the slide there, that annual HCV testing is recommended for people who inject drugs and specifically for HIV seropositive men who have unprotected sex with men. And periodic testing should be offered to other persons with ongoing risk factors for exposure to hepatitis C. I work in a large FQHC system. Our HIV primary care practice has about 2,400 HIV positive patients, and we deal with a very high risk patient population, most of whom are ongoing engaging in some sort of risk. And so we sort of test everybody once a year for hepatitis C as just part of their routine care. And certainly in some cases, it may even be more frequently. So after somebody is tested for hepatitis C, what does the guidance recommend? And so I put these in here because it's the same for our co-infected patient population. There isn't much difference. And where there are salient differences for treatment and other things, I will point them out. But for the most part, when we think about the co-infected patient population, we treat them very similarly, all the way from testing to cure, as we do our mono-infected patient population. So an anti-HCV test is recommended as the first line test. And if the result is positive, we should be confirming with a sensitive HCV RNA test. Now, what I will tell you is that the current standard of care really is based in reflexive testing. So your major reference laboratories, Quest, LabCorp, both offer a reflexive test model. And what that means is in one tube of blood, you draw the antibody test, it gets sent to the lab, and in that same tube of blood, if the antibody test is reactive, Quest and LabCorp will then perform a confirmatory test. And this is really, really important because we know that about 50% of individuals, if they just get the antibody test alone, will not get the confirmatory test done. And so we want to make sure that individuals are going forward and getting the full story of their infection, that we don't have to ask them to come back for a second blood draw. If you do this on a high volume, it would really create an unnecessary burden on your patients, but certainly on your practice to bring individuals back for a second set of labs or perhaps even for a second visit. And then it is quite complicated to try to explain to a patient, you may have it, you may not have it. There's a 25% chance that you don't, but we need this other test. If you can just get the full story in one tube of blood, it makes things a lot simpler. So for all of you who are listening, if you can think about automating or eliminating an HCV antibody test alone from your orders menu and rather substituting that with the reflexive test option, you'll be really streamlining the services that you provide to your patient population and the stressors that you put on yourselves and your own staff. Now, the second line here is among persons with a negative anti-HCV test who are suspected of having liver disease, testing for HCV RNA or follow-up testing for antibody is recommended if exposure to HCV occurred within the past 6 months. Because remember, they can be in a window period, and testing for HCV RNA can also be considered in persons who are immunocompromised. And this is really where our HIV patient population comes in. If we have individuals with CD4 counts of less than 200 or at some point had a CD4 count of less than 200 and they may not have been able to generate antibody, we may just want to be testing them for RNA. And I'll show you an algorithm after this slide that really sort of takes that into account. So if somebody gives you a known exposure or if they have transaminitis, you may want to consider just going straight to the RNA test, even in the setting of a negative antibody test. And also remembering to share with your patient population that if they've either spontaneously cleared a virus and have a positive antibody test or they've been treated and cured, that antibody test may always be positive. And then they need to be screened moving forward with initial HCV RNA testing because that anti-HCV is always going to be there. And so really providing some guidance to our patients, making sure they're empowered to talk with their future providers or whoever is going to be doing their screening to say, hey, listen, that antibody test doesn't mean anything to me. I've been told it's positive in the past, but I either got rid of it on my own or I was cured, so I need the viral load test. Always needing an RNA viral load or quantitative test prior to initiation of antiviral therapy. We need to document that baseline level of viremia. In some cases, it impacts how we choose which regimen. There's one regimen in particular, if the viral load is less than 6 million copies, then they can get 8 weeks of treatment instead of 12 if they're not HIV co-infected and if they're not cirrhotic. In our HIV patient population, it's always 12 weeks, but it's good to have a sense of what their baseline level of viremia is. always need genotype as well to guide selection of the most appropriate antiviral regimen, unless, of course, you're in a resource-limited setting and you have access to a pan-genotypic regimen, which happens mostly abroad. And I could argue in some FQHC settings, if you're getting free drug from a drug company to treat somebody who is uninsurable, then you could argue that perhaps you could treat without knowing the genotype if you're using a pan-genotypic regimen. But for the most part, the recommendation is to always know the genotype to help guide selection of the most appropriate antiviral regimen, and most payer systems will require you to do that as well. And then the last point here, if an individual is found to have positive results for an anti-HCV test but is negative for viral RNA, then they should be informed that they don't have evidence of active infection. And I would even say at that point, they should receive some harm reduction counseling as to how to keep themselves negative in the future. This is an algorithm that is not taken from the AASLD IDSA guidance, but rather from HRSA. It's a very specific document that's geared towards co-infected individuals. And this really just sort of highlights what I mentioned before, that individuals who are immunocompromised and may not have been able to mount an antibody response to their hepatitis C infection, to consider even in the setting of a negative HCV antibody test to take a look at their transaminases. Now, we all know if we treat hepatitis C that you don't need a transaminitis and it's not always present in the setting of a hepatitis C infection. But if somebody has an elevated ALT and their antibody test is negative, really think carefully and consider doing a quantitative RNA test. And I would even say if they've given you a very strong history or have a known exposure and they have a very low CD4 count or have a history of a very low CD4 count, you may want to consider screening with a viral load test just to make sure that they're not infected. For individuals who have resolved their infection, again, remembering that you always have to do the screen with the viral load test, not the antibody test, because that will persist as a positive test result. So when we counsel individuals with current active infection, I'm just going to walk you through here. These are all can be found again in the guidance, but I think it's important to make sure that we know how to message to patients who are newly diagnosed with hepatitis C or perhaps have known they've been positive for a while but have never sought care. I think it's really important to make sure that you let them know that there is good treatment available. But we also want to make sure that we reduce the progression of liver disease and prevent transmission of hepatitis C as well. So again, counseling around alcohol use, and then if appropriate and the patient is open to it, facilitating cessation of alcohol consumption with referral to alcohol treatment programs. If there are other conditions that can accelerate fibrosis, including hepatitis B, we want to make sure that we're controlling those. And we'll talk a little bit about hepatitis B and the complex interplay with hepatitis C, even more so with HIV as we move forward. And then we need to evaluate individuals for advanced fibrosis. Now, our options are much more varied than they have been in the past. Historically, liver biopsy was considered the gold standard. It's no longer so. In fact, I have not ordered a liver biopsy on any of my patients in more than 2 years. Non-invasive markers are really now what we're using. And so strategies like FibroScan, otherwise known as transient elastography, which really measures how much scarring is in the liver by sending a shear wave force and seeing how it bounces off the liver. You can imagine that a cirrhotic or very scarred down liver doesn't bounce very well and absorb the shear wave. Instead, it bounces it off and it gives you a very high reading. If someone has a nice, healthy, soft, pliable liver, a shear wave force is nicely absorbed by the liver and it gives you a lower reading. And so transient elastography has really become a great modality. It's non-invasive. It's just like an ultrasound machine where you put some jelly on someone's belly and they take some pictures. The patients are not uncomfortable in any way, shape, or form. But there are also biomarkers too. So some of you may have used either a HEPA score or a FibroSure in your practice, or APRI scores, which are composite measurements and calculations that you can use to kind of estimate how much scarring is in somebody's liver, really moving more towards those. And so it's helpful. Really, the most important thing as a provider is to determine whether or not somebody is cirrhotic or not. Because if somebody is cirrhotic, they need ongoing hepatocellular carcinoma screening. And that usually needs to occur even after cure. If they have cirrhosis at the time of treatment, even after you get rid of the hepatitis C, you still need to make sure you're doing those Q6-month ultrasounds plus or minus an AFP for your patient. For all individuals who are chronically infected, hepatitis C, both mono-infected and clearly our co-infected patient populations, they need their Hep A and B vaccines. So getting serologies and making sure that you immunize your patients is important. And in the guidance, it says that vaccination against pneumococcal infection is recommended to all patients with cirrhosis, but for those of us that are treating our co-infected patients, we're already needing to provide pneumococcal vaccine for all of our HIV-positive patients. So even if they're not cirrhotic, we need to be doing that anyway. And then, of course, individuals should be counseled on how to avoid HCV transmission with others, so harm reduction counseling around safe injection practices, and particularly among our HIV-positive MSM, but also patients that engage in heterosexual sex as well. Harm reduction counseling, safe sex counseling is important so our patients can make informed decisions. Additional laboratory testing. So within 12 weeks prior to starting antiviral therapy, always want to make sure you get that complete blood count and an INR. And I think for any of you who have prescribed treatment in the past, all of these are often required by our insurance companies as well, that we need to submit these labs, not just for good medical care, but also to get approval of direct acting agents. You want to check albumin, total and direct bilirubin, your transaminases and alk phos levels, and then of course make sure that individuals have good creatinine clearance and GFR, and checking genotype and subtype as we discussed in that baseline viral load. I think it's really important to talk a little bit here about HBV co-infection. So there was recently a black box warning on direct acting agents that individuals who are co-infected with hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and this is an HIV infected or non-infected patients, but if they're co-infected with B and C, once you are treating the hepatitis C, the hepatitis B has been documented to have the potential to flare. And in some cases, particularly abroad, there's been a fulminant liver failure associated with that. So all individuals with HCV DAA therapy should, before they initiate therapy, be assessed for HBV co-infection. You want to check the surface antigen, the surface antibody, and then core antibody as well. And if the core antibody is positive, I would consider checking a viral load as well, just to make sure there's no active replication present. Okay. And in those individuals that do have a hepatitis B co-infection, if they meet the criteria for treatment, I would go ahead and begin that treatment for hepatitis B prior to initiating HCV DAA therapy and try to get control of the virus prior to treating the hepatitis C. Testing for the presence of resistance-associated substitutions, otherwise known as RASs, formerly called RAVs, variants, V for variants, prior to starting treatment should be performed. And there are complex reasons for that, all of which you can find in the treatment guidance, but it does impact drug choice as well, and it depends on the genotype RAS you're looking for. Most common in the United States is genotype 1A, and there are important treatment decisions that you have to make based on the presence of RASs within genotype 1A, and it can affect duration as well as drug choice. Anyone who's scheduled to receive an NS3 protease inhibitor should also be assessed for a history of decompensated liver disease and for severity of disease using a Child Turcotte-Pugh score. And so I think it's important to consider doing a CTP score on all of your patients, because if somebody is cirrhotic and they are teetering on the verge of decompensation, you really want to make sure that they see a liver transplant specialist and that that medication be provided in conjunction with a liver transplant specialist. So I just want to give that disclaimer first, but particularly for individuals who are going to be receiving protease inhibitors, they can be pretty dangerous in individuals who have a child, a CTP score of 7 or greater. It can really decompensate individuals, and we should not be using protease inhibitors in that patient population. If someone has a marginal score of 5 or 6 and can't be closely monitored for laboratory or clinical symptoms during treatment, they should not receive treatment with a regimen that contains paratopravir or ritonavir. So just a note, but for those of you that are going to be treating in a primary care setting, if somebody has a either child's PUB or C score, I would recommend referring them to a liver transplant specialist or hepatologist so that they can be more closely monitored and leave that decision-making to them if there is one in the near vicinity. So staging of liver fibrosis. So we talked a little bit about this and why it's important to identify cirrhotics versus non-cirrhotics. Again, in cirrhotic patients, there's an increased hepatocellular carcinoma risk. You have to screen, you have to monitor them for hepatic decompensation, and you also want to consider that liver transplant evaluation. And we can determine cirrhosis by the measures that I've already mentioned, either by liver biopsy, which has fallen out of favor just for the purposes of staging, and also the non-invasive test. Monitoring for hepatocellular carcinoma, as I mentioned, this is important to do even after a patient with cirrhosis has been cured. You want to make sure you get a hepatic ultrasound, and really a plus or minus an AFP, but really it's the imaging that's important. That should be done every 6 months. Any suspicious lesion requires more specific testing with a multi-phase CT or an MRI. And remembering that AFP alone now is inadequate screening test for hepatocellular carcinoma, and routine screening for HCC without advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis is not recommended. For our cirrhotic patients, again, considering referral to a liver transplant specialist for those who you have concern for decompensation, you always want to look for encephalopathy, presence of ascites. They may need diagnostic paracentesis or evaluation for liver transplant. And all cirrhotic patients should have an endoscopy to evaluate for the presence of esophageal varices. They may need prophylaxis with this non-selective beta blocker. When we talk about treatment, I think it's really critical to recognize that the goal of treatment is really to reduce all-cause mortality, liver-related adverse consequences, including end-stage liver disease, cancer. And we do this by achieving virologic cure, as evidenced by what we call a sustained virologic response, or SVR. And the ASLD IDSA Guidance Committee says that treatment is recommended for all patients with chronic HCV infection, except those with short life expectancies that can't be remediated by treating the hepatitis C or transplant or an other directed therapy. So this is a critical point, because I know that there are some jurisdictions around the country that are really rationing treatment for individuals with the sickest livers with Medivir scores of 2, 3, or 4, but guidance recommends that everybody with hepatitis C should be treated unless you're going to die with really with a short life expectancy, usually within a year's time. So we've come a long way with respect to treatment. Some of you who are listening may have had experience using interferon-based regimens dating back to as far as 1986, where cure rates, SVR rates, were less than 10%. With the addition of ribavirin, there was a little bit more success for cure. When we pegylated our interferon and added ribavirin, we could expect perhaps a 50% cure rate. And then in 2011, we had our first direct-acting agent. And really, direct-acting agents are exactly that. They act directly on the virus, whereas interferon and ribavirin really act as immunomodulators, kind of revving up the immune system to try to kick the virus out. They had a lot of side effects, were poorly tolerated, and were 48 weeks of treatment. Now we have direct acting agents, all oral regimens, gone are the days of interferon, with cure rates that now exceed 95%. Different classes of direct acting agents now exist. There's NS3, 4A inhibitors, NS5A inhibitors, there are NS5B inhibitors, and then non-nucleoside inhibitors as well. They all work at different parts of the virus. And here's a simple mnemonic to remember some of the DAAs. If they start, if the second half of the word starts with PRE, think of those as our protease inhibitors. If there's a UVR, as in sofosbuvir or dasabuvir, they can be either nucleotide or non-nucleotide polymerase inhibitor. And if it ends in asvir, like ledipasvir, ombitasvir, decladasvir, can be an NS5A inhibitor. The factors associated with treatment and cure, again, genotype, the stage of liver fibrosis, really focusing on cirrhosis versus non-cirrhosis, whether they're naive or experienced. And then there's always special populations, whether or not folks have chronic kidney disease, the children, transplant, et cetera. There are medications that are currently FDA approved. Actually, earlier in the week, which occurred after I had to turn in my slide, there was another medication. It's actually a tri-pill. Sofosbuvir, Velpatasvir, and Sofalvox is now approved. But up until a week ago, these were the medications that were currently FDA approved. And you can see that we have a lot of options at this point in time. We have options across all genotypes, and you can see that there is even a pan-genotypic regimen in Sofosbuvir, Velpatasvir that allows us to treat all genotypes with one pill once a day. So fixed dose combination regimens have really become the standard of care. So we are as simple now as one pill once a day, ranging anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks. Again, 8 weeks is not really an option for a co-infected patient population, but 12 weeks is currently. There are some regimens, however, that are not recommended for HIV and Hep C co-infected patients. And a lot of this has to do with the antiretroviral regimens and drug-drug interactions. And I've listed them here for you. You can use this as a reference. And again, the ASLD IDSA guidance has a very thorough listing of drug-drug interactions as well. But I think that all medications, all the DAAs that are available can be used in co-infected patient populations, but we just need to be mindful as prescribers as to how the drugs interact with somebody's specific regimen. And if you can adjust their HIV regimen, if they're not limited by drug resistance, then that's the thing to do. I think it's really important to make sure that your patients are virologically suppressed in terms of their HIV. You want to get them on a regimen that works for them, that's well tolerated, and then layer on top their hepatitis C medication. I'll also mention that treatment interruption for HIV is not recommended to accommodate hepatitis C treatment, according to the guidance. That's important. There are also ribavirin drug interactions that, if those of you who have been treating for a while may be aware of, you do not want to use adobudine with ribavirin or didanazine with ribavirin. Not that many of us are using either of those drugs anymore, certainly not stabudine as well. But abacavir also may compete intracellularly with ribavirin. And if you want to decrease the ribavirin using weight-based dosing, there's no decrease in SVR. So that's a good tip to know. Instead of talking about what drugs don't work, I've tried to create for you here a little bit of a can-do sort of table, again, adapted from the treatment guidance. And so this gives you a sense of what medications can be used with our most commonly used antiretroviral therapies. And so there's a lot of leeway here. This is not that hard to find a treatment regimen that works for most of our patients. So rest assured that for the most part, except for our very complicated patients who have had a very challenging HIV treatment histories and have developed a lot of resistance over time, for the most part, you're going to be able to find really good modern regimens for their HIV that work very nicely with their hepatitis C direct-acting agent regimens. Here's the recommended regimens according to ASLD IDSA guidance. Co-infected persons should be treated and retreated the same as persons without HIV infection, of course, after recognizing and managing the interaction. So we've already discussed that. I think that this is a nice important tip here that daily Declatisvir plus Sofosbuvir with or without ribavirin is a recommended regimen when antiretroviral regimen changes cannot be made to accommodate alternative HCV direct-acting antiviral. So you always have Declatisvir plus Sofosbuvir to lean on if you're in a tough spot with a lot of HIV drug resistance. And as I've already shared with you, treatment courses shorter than 12 weeks, such as the use of 8 weeks of Ledipasvir or Sofosbuvir, are not recommended for co-infected patients. So right now, our co-infected patients, the shortest we can go is 12 weeks time. And just a quick note that if you are going to use a Declatisvir-based regimen, Declatisvir would require dose adjustments with both ritonavir, boosted atazanavir, and efavirenz or etravirine. There's a couple things to note here around monitoring, according to ASLD IDSA guidelines. There's some leeway because clinic visits or telephone contact is recommended as clinically indicated. And what I will tell you is that I see my patients and much more often than is recommended according to the recommendations that follow here. I have a large patient population. Many are homeless. Many are actively using drugs. And we see them back in clinic very frequently as well. And I honestly do check the HCV viral load, not because I'm concerned, but because we check it more frequently than is recommended by guidance, because it provides a tremendous amount of positive reinforcement for our patients. And they're excited to see how they're doing. They're excited to see their viral load go down. And so as long as they're open and they want to get their blood drawn, we're happy to do it for them, because it gives us a sense of how they're doing with adherence, and it gives them a sense of accomplishment as they're making their way through treatment. According to guidance, the CBC, a creatinine level, in addition to their GFR, hepatic function panel should be checked 4 weeks after treatment initiation and as clinically indicated. So I use that last statement as a little bit of my green light to go ahead and engage my patients in a more regular way. Patients receiving Elbivir and Grazoprevir should be monitored with hepatic function panel also at 8 weeks after treatment, and again at 12 weeks if they're receiving 16 weeks of treatment. And it's important to watch somebody's ALT and AST for some folks. If they have a tenfold increase at week 4, or a less than tenfold increase with symptoms, then you should discontinue treatment. And really, that is one of the only circumstances where we discontinue direct acting agent therapy, because that would indicate that there could be a fulminant liver failure process happening that could be dangerous to the patient. If somebody has a less than tenfold increase in their transaminases and no symptoms, you just repeat those ALT, AST at week 6 and 8. When it comes to viral load testing, the guidance recommends checking at 4 weeks of therapy and then not again until you're looking for SVR, which is 12 weeks following completion of therapy. And again, my disclosure is I use this as a tool for positive reinforcement for my patients and to continue to engage them. But actually, clinically, you don't need to do it as often. Antiviral therapy should not be interrupted or discontinued if viral load testing is not able to be done, either if the patient doesn't come in or if they're uninsured, you should not stop therapy. And viral load testing can be considered both at the end of treatment and 24 weeks of longer following completion of treatment as well. But the standard is usually 12 weeks after the completion of therapy is how we assess SVR. I also like to get a SVR check at the end of treatment just to document that at the end of treatment that person was still virologically suppressed. Patients with compensated cirrhosis on paratopervir and ritonavir-based regimens should be monitored per guidelines, and that is a much more complicated thing that sort of exceeds what we're able to do in the hour today. And again, for our hepatitis B surface antigen positive patients who aren't already on HBV suppressive therapy, you want to monitor their hepatitis B DNA levels during and immediately after treatment to make sure that they're not having a surge in infection. And antiviral treatment should be given if criteria are met for hepatitis B, and most oftentimes they are. And in terms of additional testing recommendations, if it's detectable at week 4 of treatment, you want to repeat that quantitative RNA viral load at week 6. Now, if the quantitative viral load has increased by greater than tenfold at repeat testing at week 6 or any time thereafter, then they recommend discontinuation of HCV treatment, because really, in my experience, that acknowledges that the patient is not taking their direct acting agents. We've had cases where the viral load is still detectable at week 6, but not greater than tenfold, but very, very low level, and even at week 8. And under those circumstances, you absolutely press on and continue. Do not discontinue treatment under any circumstances. So at this time, we'd like to open up for questions and answers.
Okay, we have a few moments here to take some questions if you have them. Please enter your questions into the questions pane on GoToWebinar toolbar, and we will address those. Okay, I have one. What insights do you have from your experience with HCV, HIV treatment in the field?
What I can share with you all is that it's incredibly gratifying work. I think especially when you're treating HIV patients where you can't cure their virus, at least not yet, to be able to offer them a cure for a virus that many have been living with for many decades is really, really exciting and empowers you not only as a provider, but also the patients. And I've seen folks who have struggled with engagement, who've struggled with adherence, if you promise them that if they take these hepatitis C medicines, they can get rid of one of their viruses, it actually even will push folks and motivate folks to reengage in their HIV care in a new way with a little bit more dedication, a little more fervor that may have gotten fatigued over time in the past. So I feel like it's, if those of you who are listening haven't treated at any scale in the past, I would highly recommend doing so because it's pretty simple, it's fun, it's exciting, and really, really gratifying for you and your patient population. And it's medically important. I shared with you that liver disease is the second leading cause of death in our HIV patient population, and that can actually be prevented by curing the hepatitis C. So, you know, for any of you who are thinking about it, if you have clinical questions moving forward, if I can be a support in any way, I'm sure that we can get you my contact information and feel free to reach out. I'm happy to help.
Okay. If you have any other questions, please enter them now. I'm going to remind you about the next session, Challenges in Access to HCV Care. That will be Wednesday, August 23rd at 12 p.m. Eastern. The registration link is here. And if you grab the attachments or the handouts in the handouts section, on GoToWebinar, this information is there also. I'm not seeing any other questions. Did you have any closing thoughts before we wrap it up?
Nope, but just thanks everyone for your attention and for logging on today to listen. I appreciate it.
All right, and thank you for participating in today's webinar. We hope that you're able to find the information provided useful as you continue your P4C project. Take care, everybody, and we'll see you next time.